A 70 Kenosha, 69 Racine, humidity 97% at 801. Excuse me, 810. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Morning Show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. We want to remind you that the Morning Show is now available as a podcast, if that is a more convenient way for you to enjoy the Morning Show. And the podcast version of the Morning Show comes to you actually 7 days a week. And it is available on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast. Look for the title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
I have had such fun reading a wonderful novel that I'm just now finishing up, which is called Repeat After Me. And it is by an author who perhaps you have heard of, who is responsible for a memoir called Foreign Babes in Beijing. Since 1994, Rachel Dawoskin has lived in Beijing, China, where she worked in public relations and then had a role in a television program there. Actually, I believe now she lives here in America with her husband and two children, but of course has very close ties to the fascinating nation of China. And that is part of what is woven into the fabric of this truly remarkable novel in which we follow the emotional ups and downs of a woman at a couple of different points in her life as a New Yorker in her early 20s who is teaching English as a second language to a small class, which includes a fascinating young man from China whom she befriends, and alternating with later scenes in this character's life in which she is living in China herself and trying to make sense of all that she has seen and experienced. This is a novel about the clash between cultures. It's about coming to terms with mistakes made. It's coming to terms with the rich and complicated intricacies of our emotional lives as human beings. All kinds of things are in the pages of this book. Again, it is called Repeat After Me. It is published by the Overlook Press, and I'm very happy to speak with its author for the next few minutes, Rachel Dawoskin. Rachel Dawoskin, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Wow, thank you for the generous introduction. I appreciate it.
Reading this novel makes me really anxious, by the way, to read your memoir, which I have heard good things about. I wonder if, having failed to actually look at that memoir before this interview, maybe you could sketch for our listeners a little bit about your life. I gave just the high points, but maybe you can fill in some of the gaps to help us better know who you are. I think that will make our conversation about your novel all the richer.
Thank you. I would love to. I actually moved to China in 1994 when I was 21 because I had just graduated from undergraduate school in New York City. And like many of my undergraduate students now, I had no idea what to do. And I thought it would be adventurous and fiery to move to China. My dad was for many years a sinologist at the University of Michigan, so I had traveled across internal China as a little kid, longing for summer camp and 4th of July and ice cubes and normal childhood staples. But instead, I got long train rides across the dusty countryside. So as a kind of homage to him, I think, in a way, and on a whim, I moved to Beijing in the fall of 1994, and I had a corporate job, which I quickly gave up when somebody offered me a role in the soap opera, for which I was ludicrously unqualified, incidentally. I'm not a talented actor. There are clips of the soap opera online. It's called Foreign Babes in Beijing, so my acting speaks for itself. But the soap opera was about, on a small scale, it was kind of about sexy Western girls falling in love with incredibly macho Chinese guys. Hmm. And in a larger sense, I think it was about a very fraught relationship between China and the West in the 1990s specifically, and kind of all the time, more generally.
Hmm. If I could just ask, did you have to act in the Chinese language? I mean, were you speaking Chinese?
Yeah. In fact, the whole show was in Mandarin Chinese, which was part of what made it so complicated for me. I had studied Chinese in undergraduate school, but I spoke very stilted and nerdy and limited Chinese. So it was a steep, steep learning curve for me just to get the dialogue right. And the dialogue was things like, I love you, what are we waiting for? And what's wrong with you Chinese guys? Can't you love anyone other than your wives? Things my undergraduate education at Columbia hadn't properly equipped me for.
How is it that you landed this job? Were you simply seen someplace in public?
I was literally at a party and some guy was like, you're white, do you want to be in my soap opera?
Wow. Interesting. How long did you do that?
We filmed the soap for like 6 months. It's actually something of a misnomer to call it a soap opera. It's more like a mini-series because in China they like to censor at every stage of the artistic process. They try to avoid filming and airing simultaneously. So we filmed the whole thing and then it ran in reruns for years and years. It was 21 episodes.
Hmm. And once that was done, then what did you do in China? And how long did you remain in China?
Once that was done, I tried to do things I thought were socially responsible. I traveled for a long time for the Ford Foundation. I did case studies on women's reproductive health and rights in rural China. And I worked for a long time for a television production company producing a show about Chinese women who were in some way changing China, you know, artists, designers, writers, activists. I did a bunch of very weird things when I lived there. My life was a kind of eclectic collage of careers. And then I wrote about that all in Foreign Babes, and I wrote about my Chinese friends who were in a very interesting transition themselves, much like their cities.
Hmm. And much like some of the characters we meet in your novel, Repeat After Me.
Right.
At what point did you meet the man who is now your husband, and at what point did you return to the United States?
My husband is a playwright named Zaid Dorn, whom I met in graduate school in Boston the minute that I moved back from China. And he's a very interesting political guy. For me, meeting him was a lot like coming home. He's very articulate, and he speaks excellent English. I felt when I got home like there were some things about America after having spent 6 years in China that felt sort of unfamiliar to me.
Hmm.
Things like very obvious things like going to the grocery store was a confusing event because there were just so many bright lights and aisles and things to choose from. And I had never rented an apartment in America, for example.
Hmm.
I had never opened my own bank account. I think China for me was the first place I had ever been an adult. So actually doing sort of logistical adult things was easier for me in China than it was in America, which was part of my culture shock in both directions.
Right. If I may make brief mention of another book, just because I'm sort of struck by the interesting parallel, and I actually don't even remember its title, but I recently interviewed the author of a book which is a memoir of a young woman who went to college someplace in New York City, might have even been Columbia University, I don't remember, but she went to China very much on a whim with a friend in the early 1980s. So,
it's Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Very charming.
Yeah, interesting book.
Yeah, it's great.
And, of course, one of the things that made this ultimately a rather disastrous trip was that it was much more on a whim than your move to China, and she was drastically ill-equipped to move there and function. How equipped were you to go to China and to live there successfully? I mean, had you extensively studied Chinese and in other ways, were you really mentally, emotionally, academically ready to do that?
You know, I would say China's a very different place now from what it was in the 90s, and certainly in the 90s it was a different place from what it had been in the 80s when I traveled there some as a kid. I think when I moved there, I was not equipped to live a life abroad, but I was very young and I was very optimistic. I had this idea that cultures are contained in their languages and that the challenge was to learn extremely fluent Chinese, and that way I would make friends and it would give me a kind of cultural access. Of course, that turned out only to be partially true. I mean, I'd say if you're thinking of moving to China, the thing to do is start learning Chinese, because it's very difficult even now to have a happy life there if you can't speak to people in their language. Hmm. But that said, I think it's much easier now to live a kind of foreign or expat life in China than it was even in the 90s, but certainly in the 80s. I think it was much harder to travel there as a foreigner. And foreigners were a big oddity back in the day. Now there's just tons of interface. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of expatriates in Beijing, and the kind of familiarity, and I would say the camaraderie between Chinese locals and expats from all over the world is just, it's much more comfortable now.
Hmm. We're speaking with Rachel Dewoskin. We're talking about her new novel, Repeat After Me. The character teaches English primarily to people who have come here from China for one reason or another, and we'll get into some of the specifics of the book in just a moment. I want to read one of my favorite moments from the book when your main character, and how do we pronounce her name?
Aisha.
Aisha says these words, "I love studying Chinese. There's something satisfying for an obsessive compulsive in the compressed logic of it, the ability of each sound to have dozens of meanings, often including conflicting ones. There are the stroke marks coming together to form characters that look like the nouns they describe." Daguet was proud that Chinese was both more sensible than English and more expressive. "I like a language somewhere in between, a Chinglish hybrid that allows for importing the most expressive components of each language into the other." That just gives us a little bit of a peek into what I'm sure, as you've already alluded to, is a really complicated and ultimately can be a very satisfying journey from one language into the other. For you personally, what was it like to learn Chinese? Under what circumstances did you acquire this language to whatever extent you were able to?
Learning Chinese has been an absolutely mind-bending experience for me. You know, I'm a person for whom the alphabet is, it's very fundamental. I spend a lot of time thinking about words. My graduate work is in poetry, and I think about words and syllables and how things fit together. And learning a non-alphabet-based language was a delightful experience. It was very difficult and frustrating, but it changed the way I think about the world in a way that's similar to the way in which China changed my thinking and my imagination, the landscape of my imagination, really. And my Chinese friends, who speak marvelous English to varying degrees of fluency, were super, super generous about teaching me Chinese, about kind of an ongoing language exchange. And we ended up sort of residing in between Chinese and English, all of us, and speaking this Chinglish hybrid, which I think is expressive of a kind of a happy side of globalization, a kind of linguistic meeting in the middle. Hmm. And there are some things you might want to describe in China or in Chinese that are particular to Chinese culture and for which the Chinese expressions are better than any English equivalent. For example, my favorite example is the expression used to describe a chaotic situation in China, which is luanqi bazao. Like, it means like chaos 7-8 grain. I mean, it makes no sense in English. There's just no way to translate it. So if I were speaking to a Chinese friend in English and trying to describe a scene I had found luanqi bazao, I would just use the Chinese. So we would just throw a Chinese word in.
Hmm. And then try to explain what it was or define
rather than try to explain in English. And so we ended up speaking very quickly in a quite delicious mix, I thought.
There are a lot of great moments in the book when we learn a bit of Chinese ourselves, and sometimes what amount to sort of Chinese concepts. And another that comes to mind from your book is something that we spell in our alphabet, X-U-Z-I. How do you pronounce that?
Shuzi.
Shuzi. Mm-hmm. Which you have a character called Old Chen saying it, explaining as, where non-action, non-assertiveness, or being like water accomplishes all things. And he says later, sometimes can be tied to a thought about quiet actors amid the chaos. You don't have to be loud, fat, and famous to be the one who shapes events and influences peoples. Sometimes it's the quiet people in the back who are having the most effect. I mean, all of that apparently tied up in these four little letters. I mean, this short little word. Tell us more about this concept. And is this something you encountered or learned about directly when you were in China?
This comes from the study of classical Chinese. And I've studied a very, very, very minute amount and know extremely little about it, but I'm quite interested in it. My dad taught for many years methods of research in classical Chinese. So when I was writing this section, I wanted Old Chen, who's Julia Tu's grandfather. This is a conversation between him and this little kid who's utterly bilingual and bicultural. I wanted him to be able to offer her some way to think about classical Chinese that was deep and that was not only about language but also about people, which is how I think about language. And so I had a long and, for me, extremely moving and interesting conversation about it with my dad.
Oh, okay.
And the Tang poems that appear in the book, I love Tang poetry, like I like classical Chinese, although I know slightly more about Tang poetry than I do about classical Chinese. Those Tang poems in the book are my own translations, which I had my dad vet for me. So we spent many, many hours talking about individual characters and all of the possible meanings around each syllable. I mean, like the section you read, one of the things that drives my love and fascination for Chinese or with Chinese is that each syllable has a billion meanings. So, I mean, on the one hand, it's problematic for a foreign speaker because if you mispronounce a syllable, it's not as if you've said nothing. In fact, you've said something else. In my case, often something incredibly inappropriate and offensive. But it also just means that there's this, like, compressed power in Chinese words that really doesn't exist in the same way in Chinese words. So Coca-Cola is a great example of this. Because in Chinese, the syllables Coca-Cola, which is just a transliteration for Coca-Cola, have a million meanings that are, like, incredibly bubbly and delicious. It means, you know, thirst and quenching and yummy and pleasurable. It's just got a whole, like, soda's worth of ways to think about each sound.
Another interesting moment, actually, with this character of Old Chen talking to the young girl is when he brings up a Chinese phrase and or concept, which apparently means one day, a thousand autumns.
Mm-hmm.
How do we say this in Chinese?
One day, a thousand autumns.
And meaning, look how fast and brilliantly China is changing. And I guess typically the exchange, you would just repeat that. But on this particular case, you have the young girl, Julia, responding with a slightly different phrase, which means one day, three autumns.
Right.
Which means something very different.
Right.
Tell us about this.
I have her say one day, three autumns, which is, it's almost the same Chengyu. Chengyu is a four-syllable expression of wisdom or a four-syllable general maxim. And she responds that way because she's lost her father. And the one that she says, her Chengyu suggests the way that one day can feel like three seasons. It's just a slight revision to Old Chen's Chengyu. And in a way, she's showing off to him because Old Chen, her grandfather, is something. He's not a scholar exactly, but he's a scholarly guy. And he loves it that she's studying classical Chinese and loves it that her Chinese is so fluent. And so she wants to impress him. But it's also a painful thing for her to bring up. And what she's saying to him is, yeah, progress has moved very quickly, but imagine how I feel with no dad. Always for me, there's this connection between what words say and what they mean for us individually, what they say in a large kind of general maxim sense, and then what they might mean to a little kid growing up with no dad. Like how Julia, too, understands language filtered through her own experience.
Of course, as we all do. So in this case, it's like when you love someone, but they're gone from your life, so you miss them a lot. Then one day feels like 3 years, or something sort of like that. Something else that is intriguing about the way you write this book, and again, we'll get to more of the framework of the story in a moment, is that we have, coming out of the mouths of various characters, rather broken, labored, earnest efforts at speaking English, with mistakes that range from not significant at all to fairly significant errors, and they strike us as entirely believable. But I wonder how specifically you are writing some of these moments for us in which you are having these people from China attempting to speak English and not doing it quite as we would. I mean, are they making the kind of errors that a person from China typically would?
You know, there's no formula to how I wrote the pigeon, to how I wrote the Chinglish, either by the Chinese characters in the book who are speaking and writing in English, or by the Western characters who are trying to speak in Chinese. For me, having spent so much of my life in those two languages, that is, the Chinese that's kind of English and the English that's kind of Chinese, it's utterly familiar to me. So I wrote a series of letters that are from Daga to Aisha, his teacher.
Yes.
And writing those was actually, it was the most effortless part of the book for me. I have dozens of Chinese friends, and they write, now that I'm half in New York and half in Beijing, we correspond in large part by email. So the cadence of that language it's utterly familiar to me. And it was actually very easy to recreate. And I tried not to pin down particulars, so it's not like there's a formula for always missing the tense or always missing the pronoun, because I didn't want it to get. I think there's a way in which writing in pidgin can be offensive if it doesn't feel accurate and legitimate and empathetic. So I just try to do it in a natural way, the way it sounds to me,
right,
when I read what my Chinese friends write and when I speak to them.
And chances are that's really the way it probably operates in real life. That in certain situations we follow the rules correctly, and in other cases we might not. And there's probably a fairly rich range of variation when it comes to that kind of thing.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right.
Something else that happens that's really kind of cute with this central character, again, did you say her name's Aisha?
Aisha.
Aisha, is that she and a friend at some point, I don't remember which character this is, they sort of trade off the kind of interesting errors of translation that they find. I mean, of maybe like a sign someplace in China that has been translated into English, but not particularly well. Tell us about any real-life experience that is kind of behind this for you.
This is my favorite game. I scour in-flight magazines in Beijing, and because I find that the awkward translation world is so funny and rich and delightful, and there are just things you could never come up with on your own. I mean, my favorite one recently was I found a scrap from an airlines magazine in the back seat of a pocket. I actually wrote about this for a found magazine piece. And it was an article about, I guess it was about fashion. I don't know, because there was only a piece of the article left, I'm not entirely sure what the context was. But it was something about jeans and how wearing the wrong kind of jeans, if you wear the wrong kind of jeans, the buttock can accidentally meet the thigh in the helpless shape of an apple or pear. I guess the idea being that if you wear unflattering jeans, you look fat. But I was hysterical. I mean, my experience teaching ESL has always been that non-native speakers of English tend to write the most expressive things. And their writing, even though it's grammatically inaccurate, has a kind of clarity that you never get if you have access to cliché. If you're a person who lives comfortably in English, I think you have a tendency to kind of put your feet on the linguistic coffee table. You know, you just kind of lie back into the ruts of your language and speak it in the easiest way as possible. Whereas if you don't have access to those ruts, you use the words that are the most descriptive or the closest to what you mean to say, and it often ends up being wildly compelling and fresh ways to describe things.
Because you're not taking all of those comfortable shortcuts.
Exactly. You don't even know what they are.
Absolutely. If you don't mind, I want to read what you have given us as apparently what was a posting on a bulletin board someplace in Beijing, I believe, which is a really a cute example of this, if I may read this.
Yeah,
is that okay?
Of course.
So this would be an example of a rather laborious English translation. Comply with public morality. Strictly prohibit casting articles from high. On October 15th, a flaming dog end was flung from upstairs and burned a fabric chair. It happened that the resident of the chair did not sit in the chair when the dog end fell, so a more hated outcome was avoided. But that heinous activity reminds the danger of casting fierce dog ends from high. Really, we have warned this many times already. Kindly hope those individuals take others' safety into account. Stop bad bombarding behavior.
Right.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, here and there, we're kind of reminded of, I don't know, a Charlie Chan movie or something. But, I mean, just the vaguest whiff of what you're saying, if one doesn't do this carefully, like when you're assigning dialogue to some of these people from China here trying to speak English, if you carelessly do this, it could very easily steer into the realm of caricature.
That I think that section is followed directly by a section about Aisha's utter inability to speak Chinese. I think she uses that notice, which is posted in the lobby of her and Julia Tu's apartment building in Beijing, and which comes from an actual notice. I mean, I've doctored it slightly, but it was there was a notice in my apartment building in Beijing about not throwing cigarette butts out the window, which was, you know, similarly and interestingly worded. But she says about that notice, Julia Tu puts it in her notebook. Julia Tu collects these kinds of things. And Aisha says, you know, I'm the kind of person who says casting fire as dog ends from a high in Chinese.
Right.
And
she does it in the
person who doesn't know the word for doorknob.
Right.
So I'm likely to describe a doorknob as a gold ball you reach up to and touch and turn to open or close the door.
Because she doesn't know the simple little word. So in other words, she's doing it in the other direction and is aware of it and freely admits it.
Right. I think it's always a two-way thing, you know, that when you move to someone else's culture and someone else's language, it changes you and it changes the way you speak and think, and you in turn change the ways your friends speak and think. But it's this kind of cultural learning or cultural mistake making and correcting and adjusting is always two-way.
Hmm.
It's never just the Chinese characters who are speaking broken English. It's always also the Americans who are trying to speak Chinese and breaking it and making terrible mistakes. I made terrible mistakes in Chinese.
Right. And, of course, at the heart of that experience for the person doing the speaking is sort of stepping across a line. You write at one point, and this is your main character speaking, learning a language makes you vulnerable. Your thoughts become as simple as your expression of them, making you lobotomized in Chinese,
mm-hmm.
even if you're brainy in English. And then you go on to mention the example you just gave. After years here, I still wobble in search of nouns for daily objects. I am the kind of person who calls doorknobs balls you turn on doors to open or shut.
Right.
I can get things done, but there's nothing poetic or compact about not knowing the word for knob.
Right.
But at the heart of that, of course, is this idea of the vulnerability of someone who is in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Chinese people are very sensitive to that vulnerability, I think. And if you move to China as a foreigner, whether you do it in the 80s or the 90s or now, people are so helpful. You know, if you humiliate yourself, as I did many times, my worst mistake was a tonal error. I was talking to my co-star on the set of Foreign Babes in Beijing, noisily, and with a large crowd of rubberneckers who were watching us film a scene. And I was saying that the professors of Chinese at Columbia are very strict, but apparently the word strict, which I pronounced, yenge, is actually supposed to be pronounced yenge, and if you pronounce it the way I did, it means castrate.
Oh, dear.
So my co-star, everybody was totally horrified when I said it, and sort of the crowd dispersed, and my co-star and I stood there staring at each other blankly, and he didn't say anything to me. And several days later, and this is a very gentle Chinese way to do this, he pulled me aside, and he said, "Remember the other day when we were having that conversation about the Chinese professors?" And I said, "Yes," and he just opened his dictionary, We all carried the little English to Chinese dictionaries around, and he just showed me the other meanings.
Wow.
It's a very polite, gentle way to correct me without embarrassing me. He didn't risk making me lose face in front of the whole crowd. Nobody said anything to me about it. And, you know, days later, when he felt I might be able to stand the truth, he revealed it to me, which I thought was very kind. People are very encouraging. Everybody will talk to you. Cab drivers are super friendly. People in the streets have conversations with you. People help you learn Chinese there. I don't think that's as true here.
We're speaking with Rachel Dewoskin. She is well known for her memoir, Foreign Babes in Beijing, which I very much want to read. I mean, even more so now than when I began this interview. But today we speak specifically about her newest book, a novel called Repeat After Me. Let's talk about the compelling central figure in your novel. I keep forgetting how you pronounce this. Aisha?
Aisha.
Who, depending on where we are reading in the book, is either a New Yorker in her early 20s trying to kind of put her life together and teaching English as a second language, and then alternating with passages in which it is years later and she is actually living in China. You have crafted her makeup in such interesting fashion, particularly because she is this interesting tangle of various flaws and foibles, and yet at her heart is someone we like so much and are rooting for.
Describe her
to our listeners and maybe give us an insight into how you went about creating her as you did.
Aisha is she's a very fragile person, and she is teaching English as a second language after having had a kind of nervous breakdown and dropping out of college herself. She's trying to kind of get back on her feet. Her parents had an ugly divorce for which she feels partially responsible, and she's just trying to kind of make her days. And she has a very kind of a kaleidoscopic way of thinking about the world and looking at the world, which her senses are crossed. She has synesthesia. She has colors for the numbers and the letters, and she has a bunch of kind of OCD habits. She likes to count words on her fingers. And at the same time, she's on some level, she's kind of tough and reasonable. I'm not like her. For me, Aisha is based on dozens of people I've known. And this was a real joy for me in writing the book, because when I wrote Foreign Babes, of course, the craft challenges are similar. You take a lot of information and you try to make it into a story that moves, that has a plot, and that sounds metrical and beautiful. But the question of fact was very different in writing nonfiction and writing fiction. So in my fiction, I got to kind of take all of my favorite qualities in people and dole them out to my characters. I didn't do that in Foreign Babes. I didn't do composite characters. I tried to be very factually accurate about who was who said what, when, what we did. I didn't make us funnier or more likable, even though I was tempted. My mom once said to me, why couldn't you have made yourself a little bit more likable in Foreign Babes in Beijing? And so I tried to do that in Aisha's English, I mean in Repeat After Me instead. I tried to make her kind of both flawed in the way that we're all flawed and kind of appealing or at her very heart a good person who's trying to kind of do right by her mom and her family and trying to forgive her parents for the mistakes they've made and trying later in the book, of course, to parent herself without having had a flawless role model and trying to understand what happened with Da Ge, this Chinese guy that she falls in love with in New York City in 1989.
One of the ways in which Aisha describes herself to another friend is that she is a peripheral person. That is, she herself is a peripheral person, you know, on the edge of things. and we do see this, that she is a bit out of step with others and not someone that has a lot of friends and so on. And I'm just really struck by that term of someone being peripheral. And the more I think about it, the more I realize I can think of a number of people in my life who probably could be called peripheral, and there's probably even been moments in my own life or in certain settings where I become a peripheral person as well.
I think we all have moments of feeling that way, feeling like we're observing the world from the outside, even sometimes feeling like you're just in the Truman Show, you know? Like the whole world is a movie that you're watching, that you're just on the outside of things. I have that feeling more when I'm in China, where I'm actually peripheral, where I'm conspicuously different and don't, I'll never exactly fit in. China gave me a kind of a way to have perspective that I didn't have before I went there. And in fact, the term peripheral comes for me from a Chinese expression, which is pangguanzhe, the observer of a game. Pangguanzhe is somebody who stands on the side and looks at something. And in the Chinese Chengyu, the idea is that the observer of a game of chess is more likely to be able to do well than the person on the inside.
Because they're seeing it all.
Because you have, because you have more perspective. On the other hand, I think being peripheral makes you feel lonely and alienated if you feel peripheral in your own life or in your own culture. And I think Aisha does feel those ways. I think she's an alienated person socially.
One of the intriguing things you assigned to her is an interesting habit by which she actually makes certain decisions or choices or ascertains whether or not something that has just happened is a good thing or not a good thing or something meant to be. I think you said a couple of minutes ago that this is a reflection of maybe her tendency towards OCD, where she does kind of a strange little game of counting words on her fingers. Explain to our listeners what you have Aisha doing.
So Aisha likes to count the letters in sentences, and if the sentence fits on five fingers, then it's true. So, for example, I love Dage. D-A-G-E is the name of this guy she falls in love with. That actually doesn't fit. It has nine letters in it. I-L-O-V-E-D-A-G-E. But she has this kind of, I think, amusing thing about if you add really, which has six letters to something, you can doctor these things. It's a way in which she makes order out of chaos. I mean, I think we all in our lives feel like some things are out of our control. And people have all sorts of coping mechanisms for that feeling. And one of them is OCD. I didn't know much about OCD. And I've never been to a shrink. So all of the scenes with psychiatrists in the book were heavily researched. I have a lot of friends who are shrinks. And they told me about obsessive compulsive disorder. And, you know, they gave me the rubrics for what her habits would be. I wouldn't have known that that was obsessive compulsive exactly.
Huh.
I made it up because I thought it was fitting. I thought, here's a person who thinks all the time about letters, who wants to create order in her kind of chaotic life. So she would do this or that. Or I think a lot of people do this kind of thing. They count their steps down the hallway, or they, you know, wash their hands the same number of time every day.
Right. I mean, it was almost spooky when I read that, because I do something in my own life I don't think I've ever told a soul, and I'm about to blurt it out over the air.
Ooh,
although I don't I don't think I make decisions by it, but I will sometimes, for fun, when I hear an interesting name, I'll sort of mentally type it with my fingers, and I'll pay attention to if I use the same number of letters on with the left and the right hand as I type the name of, you know, opera singer Joan Sutherland or something like that. For no particular reason. I mean, I don't act on that information, but it's this thing I do, and I have no idea why I do it. But there was sort of an eerie echo of that in this thing that you have Aisha doing. But my word, it's a really interesting insight into just how vulnerable a person she is, and maybe a little bit of an insight into how waywardly she has made some of the decisions she's made, some of which were really fairly significant mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us a bit about how you crafted this intriguing character of Dage, who studies English with her, a man from China, young man from China, who is scarred from dramatic events which he has lived through. Tell us how you created him, and again, to what extent he is an echo of actual people you knew in China.
I would say, you know, again, like Aisha, he's an echo of me in large part, and also of a lot of people I know, including Chinese guys, but some Chinese women I know. A lot of his vocabulary comes from my Chinese friends, the words he picks to describe things. But his broken heart is, for me, not really culturally informed exactly. I mean, I'm interested on a profound level in how people internalize political struggles, how things that happen in your country or in your city, or things that are, you know, the result of actions of your country or your city, impact people on the ground on a very personal level. I end Foreign Babes in Beijing with a conversation about this because right before I left Beijing to come and study poetry in the United States, NATO was responsible for the bombing of a Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And it was a very painful moment for those of us who lived in Beijing because Beijing felt suddenly volatile. I mean, people were furious about it, you know, righteously furious about it. And it all of a sudden a kind of switch flipped, and there was an enormous amount of anti-American sentiment on the ground there that filtered quite quickly down to the streets. And Da Ge, for me, is a representation of how that can happen very fast, not just anti-American, not even a specific thing exactly, but how you can take what happens in your country, whether it's, you know, June 4th, 1989, as it is for him, and make it personal, how it comes to represent you or to drive the way that you behave elsewhere. Aisha, the section of the book that's set in Beijing is set the year after 9/11.
So for both of these characters, they are in a sense rebounding from or recoiling from events of great trauma which have affected them in one way or another.
Right. Each of them has a kind of a personal heartbreak, a family heartbreak, and each of them has a larger heartbreak, a sort of hometown heartbreak or a country heartbreak. And neither of them, incidentally, is in his or her hometown when the event happens. I mean, it's about being away. It's about feeling like maybe you weren't in the place your country needed you to be in at the moment when your country needed you, or you weren't in the place where your family needed you to be in the moment when your family needed you, and what those presences and absences end up meaning for you.
Something quite poignant about the character of Da Ge, about among many things, is when he tries to describe what it is like for him to be a foreigner here in America. At one point, you have him saying, "Now I am foreigner, and every country have a kind of box for foreigner. In New York, I live like in that dark box."
Yeah.
And it's really scary and heartbreaking to think about how for many people who come to this country, hearts brimming with hopes for a richly improved life, that for some of them, it is this kind of experience which awaits them instead.
I think it's true. I think people, I mean, I used to walk by the embassy lines in Beijing and just marvel over the number of people trying to get here. And if you have conversations with, you know, biologists who work as manicurists and teachers who work in restaurants, and, you know, there's a big sacrifice that people make when they come in this direction. I think the sacrifice expatriates make going in the, you know, from here to China is slightly different. And obviously there are exceptions. I mean, there are doctors and lawyers and business people who come here as well. But I think for a lot of people, moving here is a very mixed blessing.
In which they give up maybe prestige and success, which they had in their homeland.
And often their families as well.
And come here and...
If you talk to immigrants, many of them have left their kids and are sending money back, have left their husbands sometimes. And Da Ge is one of those people. I mean, he's left his father in Beijing, and he's left what's culturally familiar to him.
One of the poignant moments in one of these letters you have him writing as part of the class he's teaching, well, at one point he describes a suicide in his immediate family. In another letter, he describes, among many things about the Cultural Revolution, the moment when his grandfather, a rather intellectual guy, was forced by circumstances to bury his books.
Right.
And I suspect this is not something you're just fabricating for a dramatic effect, but is a very real part of that cultural revolution.
I think people hid intellectual treasures. I've never heard of that specific example. I did fabricate it, but I think, I mean, there was, you know, you weren't really allowed to have this sort of property. And obviously art was destroyed and books were destroyed. And so I had this idea that Old Chun would bury his things.
Hmm.
That Old Chun's father, that is, would bury his things to keep them safe. And then later they would be preserved.
Hmm. Really makes you think about those moments in life when someone is compelled to decide what is important, what has to be discarded, what will be held on to, no matter what the cost. And, of course, so many other fascinating threads are woven together in this really fascinating novel. I wonder, in this last question, did you intend right from the start for your novel to be so wonderfully complex, or did it sort of evolve into that state as you told this story?
That's such a kind question. Thank you for phrasing it that way. I worked on the book for years and years and years, and when I first drafted it, it was a much thinner and more streamlined story. But precisely because I want to make the point that these cultural exchanges are two-way, I decided that I had to have it half in New York and half in Beijing. And I wanted parts of it in the English kind of Chinese, in the English kind of Chinglish, and parts of it in the Chinese kind of Chinglish. And I wanted her to be changed by him in the same way that he's going to be changed by her. And that ended up complicating it dramatically.
Mm. Well, with absolutely delicious, compelling effect. The novel, again, is called Repeat After Me. It is published by the Overlook Press. And the author is Rachel Dewoskin. And again, her memoir is also Foreign Babes in Beijing. Rachel Dewoskin, I've thoroughly enjoyed this. I can scarcely wait to finish the novel, and I appreciate this opportunity I've had to speak with you on the morning show. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me tell you what morning show interviews are coming your way via the morning show podcast this weekend. Tomorrow, out of the archives, a really memorable conversation that I was privileged to record with highly regarded journalist Robert McNeil. For many years, of course, the host of the PBS series The McNeil-Lehrer News Hour. And someone whose journalistic career took him all over the country and around the world, covering some of the most important stories of the last half of the 20th century. His interesting memoir is called Looking for My Country, and it's a look at not only his career as a journalist, but also what it was like to grow up in Canada, but then make his home in the United States. On Sunday's Morning Show podcast, it is sports writer Ron Paschke and his wonderful book called Tommy Lasorda, I Live for This. Tommy Lasorda, of course, one of Major League Baseball's most renowned and popular general managers. Monday on the Morning Show broadcast over WGTD, you'll hear my conversation with Peter Steiner. Peter Steiner is a well-known cartoonist for The New Yorker magazine, and he has also turned his considerable talents to the writing of novels, and his most recent is called The Good Cop. And Peter Steiner's novel is set in Munich, Germany, just after the end of the First World War. And it was, of course, during that tumultuous period that Adolf Hitler rose to power. Next week, we will also have conversations with Lisa Konetsky, talking about the production of Lost in Yonkers at the Racine Theatre Guild, which actually opens tonight. But we won't catch up with guest director Lisa Konetsky until next week. Also next week on the morning show, you'll hear me talk with Nick Huff, a relatively recent graduate from Carthage College who happens to be a former voice student of mine who has scored some tremendous successes in his young career. He is coming back to Kenosha to sing a recital at Kenosha's Creative Space on Friday night, September 20th, and we'll be talking with him about that. We remind you that the morning show is archived on our website, wgtd.org. And if you're interested in subscribing to the Morning Show podcast, you can go to all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast. Be sure that you look for the title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elk.